You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 479. Hello and welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White, recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Not the greatest place in the world, but a place in the world. Definitely exists. Joining me on tonight's show.
You got that big waterfall thing. People know about that.
We do. We got half of it.
It exists.
I mean, we have territory.
It's the better half. If you're being fair, it's the better half.
Everybody always
says, oh, you got to see it from the Canadian side.
I mean, that's not your fault, though. That's not a character flaw. That's not a flaw of the American people as to which half of the water.
One of the few things. One of the few things that you don't consider a flaw of the American people.
No,
right?
I can't blame you. I can't blame.
What about John? Can you blame John?
George W. Bush or Donald W. Trump or the other George W.
Ronald
Bush.
Ronald W. Reagan.
Ronald W. Reagan. I can't blame any of them for that. So it's just.
How about Thatcher? Can you blame Thatcher?
I can blame Ronald W. Thatcher. Absolutely. So joining me on tonight's show, Mr. John Gentile out of Philadelphia.
Pardon me while I crack open a beer.
A root beer.
See, you know what? It didn't even sound like a beer, didn't it?
No, it didn't, because it's only one of those 7.5-ounce cans.
There's a certain acoustic quality to liquor that just didn't happen there. And Mr. Tom Trauma in Grand Rapids-ish.
I do have a very stiff, tall drink in front of me in a pint glass, so I don't have to refill. Even though I surely will want to refill by the time we're done, but that's all right.
I love how A&W root beer cans look like mini barrels. And I also love the vanilla after flavor. As far as commercial grade root beers go, it's good. It's good stuff.
Barks, dude. Barks has bite.
Too much bite and sugar for me. I like A&W.
I don't have a horse in this race. My daughter likes root beer a lot. She's a big fan.
All right. Apparently, you love to hate root beer because they think it tastes like child medicine.
I don't hate root beer at all. It's just that.
Well, you don't live in Europe, do you?
What?
I said in Europe.
In Europe, they. Oh, see, this is why I don't listen, because it's, you know.
I don't mind root beer, but I very, very rarely drink soda. And if I want root beer, I want a couple of scoops of vanilla ice cream in there, dude. I'm going to float that thing up. You know, I worked in fountain pop for many, many years, and since I don't do that anymore, like for the last 4+ years, I just don't even want to drink it. Glad I didn't have a job in beer, and then I wouldn't want to drink beer anymore. That'd be terrible.
I've just learned like the worst beer-related fact, and it's really going to kill me.
What's that?
So my office is on a little dead end street that the city of Niagara Falls has been for years promoting as a future like business development park or something like that. But it was just a field, right? Just a field. So then this year they finally got some tractors out there, and they took the street on which I work, and they've extended it into that field, in through the dirt, in through the muck to an adjacent street. And they've started building this massive building that looks kind of like a warehouse on that side. But in behind the warehouse, in the field, there was a bunch of brewing tanks laying in the field, covered in tarps. And every day I drive by this place on the way to work on my newly extended road here. And I drive by it and I'm like, is that a brewery? Are they putting a brewery in there? I wonder if they're putting a fucking brewery in there. And every day I see a little bit more evidence. And I have now uncovered the floor plan of the place, and it is not only a brewery, but it is a brew pub, and a massive one. And it's going to be on the street where I work, which is also happens to be like basically like a 5-minute drive from my house. And this place is going to kill me. Like, assuming that their product is any good, which, you know, it's probably fine. It's beer. It's going to kill me. It's going to be my place. It's going to be my place, and I can fucking walk there.
If the food's good. So
is it going to be like your own personal Cheers? Like you walk in?
It is, yes. I'm going to walk in.
It's
going to
be too big, though. It's going to be too big. It'll be too impersonal for that. Cheers has to be kind of a small neighborhood.
I'm
going to
walk
place.
In there like 45 seconds after they open and be like, hey, I'm Adam. I live over there, and I'm going to point at my house. And I'm like, and I work over there, and I'm going to point at my office. And you are right in between, and we are going to die together. And then...
Do you have some sort of a mug club that I can join and get $1 off each time I get my mug?
I'm going to unroll a sleeping bag and I'm going to put it over here in the corner, and that's going to be my corner.
No, you drive to work or no?
I mean, I do, but it's close enough to my house that I bike to work sometimes in the summer if I don't have to drop the kids off somewhere. Like it's so you fucking close.
That'd be, you know, if you're going to go to the bar, you probably should bike. And then, cause I was going to say you share a car with your wife, right?
Yeah, I do.
So she can't even come pick you up, or she'd have to walk.
But she doesn't need to. That's the thing. I could go there. I could irresponsibly drink beer. I could just leave my car there and walk home and then walk there the next morning and pick up my car and go to work. Like it is insanely close to where I live to a degree that it's going to wreck me. It's going to wreck me. I'm so excited, but it's going to wreck
me. You know what's funny, Adam? So, you know, when I was younger, I was not very responsible. But now that I'm older, I'm responsible. And a few years ago, my buddy and I used to go to the bar almost every Thursday night. That was like guys' night out, right? Go blow off a little steam on a Thursday night. And we didn't want to drive. So, and we hardly ever do it anymore. So when we do it now, we usually have one of our wives drive us off and the other one pick us up. But they get irritated. That 11 o'clock pickup is usually pretty irritating.
We used to
ride our bikes. And the funny thing about it is we were like 40-year-old guys who were like pretty respectable in the community. Like he's the chief of the fire department. And like my dad was the mayor and I'm on some boards and stuff. You know what I mean? We were like two respectable guys and we'd go to the bar and get hammered and ride our bikes home.
You know, it's technically DWI, you know.
It's not. That's an old wives' tale. Look it up.
All right,
It's only motor. It's only a motor vehicle.
Which state? You're talking about Michigan, right?
Yes.
Oh, no, see, you're actually going to look it up. I like just like look it up like you go into Google and just like bang, bang out the question and you get the non-geographic specific
Michigan
answer.
Michigan drunk driving statute. All right, here we are. Section 257625, Michigan legislature. Here we go. Any person, whether licensed or not, shall not operate a vehicle upon a highway
It's a motorized vehicle, John.
The statute says vehicle right here, Tom. There's no motorized.
Bike ain't a vehicle. It's a bike.
What's the Michigan definition of a vehicle?
I don't know.
Look it up.
Whatever. Don't Michigan, care.
Yeah, okay.
Don't care. I don't do it anymore. I think I probably don't even have air in my bike tires.
All we're saying is you're going to jail, Tom.
I mean, that's possible, but you know, not for that, probably.
You know, Adam, on the last podcast you were talking about, you know, I never knew why Ricky quit the podcast. I remember why Ricky quit the podcast. It's because we kept trying to set him up for arson. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, listen, you can reach that podcast at punknews.org. We love getting your mail. Tom, you take a little bit of a punch here and there today, and I'm afraid you're going to take another punch from one of the readers who is not too happy with you. I will say that I'm on the fence myself. I'm certainly not condemning Tom, but I don't know if I can get gung-ho behind Tom on this one issue 100%. I will say Tom is not a hateful person, and Tom doesn't have a mean bone in his body. So I think the issue is not in regards to intention. It is merely in regards to expression. Boy. Here's what the writer has to say. This is Bob. He's written it a couple of times before. Here's what Tom says. I know Tom prides himself on being a non-woke punk, but I was really disappointed to hear him throw out the phrase tramp stamp on the pod and have none of you call him out on that dated ass bullshit.
Oh, this has got to be a joke, right?
No, it's real. This is real. And I think he also continued.
Oh, my gosh. Bobby, I think you and I are going to have to agree to disagree, my friend.
I totally understand the issue of habit breaking, but like it's just so disheartening to hear like more PC language on my basketball pods than on the Punk News one, you know. And that's what Bobby has to say. And I
didn't even know tramp stamp was offensive. It's just like it's just like mullet. It's just like a term for a silly dated thing.
That was, I mean, I don't want to tell anybody what they should or shouldn't find
I'm not
offensive,
a hateful person,
but
Bobby,
like,
but I'm starting to not like you. Well, no, it's just that, I didn't certainly didn't mean it mean spirited.
Yeah, I mean, I read it as like an old, it's like an old colloquialism. It's like it's like, you know, like not that I'm saying that we shouldn't consider our language or anything like that, but just one of those stupid things that like is a phrase that you don't think about too much. Like I'm positive.
Yeah, no,
that,
I never put it in any kind of negative context.
I mean, I find
it's because the tramp part, I guess, right? Because it's like, yeah. Like, that's another word for slut. Well, I tell you what, dude, I honestly had no, was not trying to put it in that context at all. It was just something I threw out there. So, but I'm not going to feel like super bad about it either. I just don't think it's a big deal.
Well, I decided that the way that we solve this problem is that we have to, on this podcast, come up
with Bobby joust.
Well, no one has to combat. What we just need to do is we need to collectively rename the tramp stamp, rename the lower back upper ass tattoo that you shouldn't have got because it's going to get all stretched and weird as you get fat.
Oh, they look cool, Adam. Come on. They totally look cool. It's just like tribal. They'll never go out of style.
Right. So, but what do we call, the upper ass tattoo?
If we rename it, I'm almost guaranteed to be more insulting than the term tramp stamp.
It's like tramp stamp is you reining it in.
I've never heard that. You know, you just never know what's going to offend somebody nowadays. I don't know.
What's your opinion on the wife beater shirt?
Same thing. I would call it that without ever. I mean, I don't think I'm condoning wife beating when I call a shirt a wife beater, and I certainly don't think I'm trying to slut shame someone if I use the term tramp stamp. I mean, I'm not.
You know what? It's weird how like you start like running into different areas where all of a sudden you don't realize what's offensive or like what's offensive in the way that certain people, but certain people will take it as like as a given almost that certain things are offensive. And the weirdest thing for me, and I mean I hate to say this because I wasn't chronic about this or anything, but I think I was like a lot of people that were from like small town nowhere back who like grew up in the 90s was like. Like so, like I was from Niagara Falls. I'm in Niagara Falls right now, and like when we were dumb 14-year-olds or 13-year-olds or whatever, like the insult everyone would throw at each other was gay, right? And it didn't mean
you weren't calling someone homosexual, like, or you weren't trying to insult homosexuals,
right?
I disagree.
If you grew up in a small town, John, if you grew up in like I grew up in Wisconsin, right? And it was definitely you were definitely challenging someone's masculinity, I think, more than actually calling it.
I think there's been a lot of post-recontextualization in that back in the 90s or 80s, you say, oh, you're gay. You definitely meant that you were homosexual and that's bad.
We wouldn't even use it for people. That was the thing. It was like, what'd you think of that movie? It would be like, that movie was gay.
Things that were boring,
right?
Were gay, right?
Yes. But
like, that's so gay. It's boring.
It's implied that the reason that it's bad is because it's gay. It's homosexual. I mean, like people are trying to say, we didn't mean gay associated with the word homosexual at all. We just meant it as another word for bad that had no connection to homosexuality. That's just not true. People know.
Have you been woke your whole life, John? You never used that term when you were young?
I certainly used that term when I was young. Everybody in the 80s.
I condemn you, John. I condemn you.
Well, go ahead. I mean, I don't use it anymore because you know.
I don't either.
But what I was getting at was
there was never any malice when I did use it. You know what I mean? I never had malice towards homosexuals.
I'm not saying anyone had mouse, but some people sure did. But people like to say now, oh, we said gay in the 90s, but we didn't mean that in homosexual. We just meant that was bad. But the reason you're saying it's bad is because it's associated with homosexuality, you know, in the 80s and 90s, what I'm saying.
I mean, I suppose, yes.
So people like to say, oh, there's no connection at all, or we didn't mean it that way. But it's implied and people did mean it that way. And that's okay. People can learn and grow and change. And, you know, I mean, it is kind of difficult to remember how LGBTA, that conversation is wide out in the open now. It was not that way in the 80s and 90s. I mean, there was almost no famous people that you knew were gay, and now there's tons of famous people that you know are gay. So, you know, it is difficult to remember how different the times really were.
Right. So where I brought that point up was just because I remember specifically the moment when we finished high school and we went to – like, we didn't go to a town that was bigger than Niagara Falls or anything like that. But we moved to a town that was like was probably like the one of the most liberal college towns in Canada, right? So to the point where like there was things that were implied in the language there that we had to like embarrassingly after the fact go figure out why that was. And I remember like, so like, you know, you get there and like almost immediately you realize that like, you know what, we're reflexively saying things like gay is just like a, you know, as a short little quippy, like, you know, reflex word. And we got to cut that out right away. Right. And that sinks in. But then you kind of like have the opposite where people are trying to like decodify other parts of the language. And it took us forever to figure out, not only to figure out what half the stuff meant, but I feel like it took us forever to like, to actually just become comfortable saying those things. So they sounded so weird for us. So I remember that like for the first, like you, first few classes of that when I was in, whenever any of like a university professor referred to a spouse, right, they referred to it as their partner. And I remember like, you know, like me and my friends that were from Niagara that all went to the same school together. We're just like why is like everyone has a partner here? And like, what does that mean? Does that mean like, are all the teachers gay and that's just how they're referring to their spouse? Like, is that what's happening? Right. Like we had this moment where like, we've never heard this be like a normal term. And every time we hear it, it just sticks out like a siren because it's so unusual to us. And just to unprogram half the shit that we were used to saying without thinking was just like a crazy experience. And like, and the internet is the internet is that in a way to the nth degree. I mean, when we saw Bobby's note there, one of my immediate reflexive defense of Tom was kind of like, Tom's like a straight white male in his 40s from the Midwest, right? Like, how is he? Why do we have to hold him up to these to the language standards of somewhere that
Tramp stand? Have you guys ever heard of anybody being offended by that?
Well, no, but I can see why they would be, right?
I mean, vaguely, but I mean, there has to be a general standard for what's offensive and what's not, and that is not. There has to be a reasonableness standard applied to it. I'm sorry, that just doesn't pass the smell test for me. I swear I thought it was a joke at first. Well, it's like these people who get upset when you call them an ambulance driver instead of an EMT. Wait, suck what? At ambulance drivers.
Yeah, take that, ambulance drivers. Listen, here's someone else that's not happy with us. This is from Stam. You can talk bad,
Bobby,
about
let's hash it out over a beer, buddy.
You can talk bad about the interrupters all you want, but they are great. I've seen them 7 times. And every single time, God, everyone there is dancing and smiling. Plus, and
every single time they play the exact same set and tell the exact same story to lead into the songs.
Plus, they do they really, Tom?
Well, I've seen them twice, and they literally played identical shows.
Was it 2 days in a row?
No. Plus, not even two tours in a row.
Plus, they pay tribute to the early punk and ska bands. How can you hate on that? Stop hating on that. Stop
being negative. Them. They're fine. They're just not good either. They're just fine.
Stop being negative and embrace the upstrokes. And that's from Stam.
Did we hate on the interrupters? You know what?
I enjoy them so much. I'm going to get an interrupters tramp stamp.
Oh, see, now you're trolling.
You're right. I'm trolling.
That is Tom. Tom, you are moving from good natured joshing to hatred. Which
I swear I've never heard anybody be offended by that before.
You're gonna be pitching around in bed tonight. Like,
I guess like I won't be able to sleep. I'm like, I can't believe I offended someone. Yeah, I think I'll sleep all right.
Well, listen, the interrupters are cool. I got the latest album. I think the latest album actually is pretty good. The thing with the interrupters though is like after you've heard it one time, that's all you're gonna get out of it. You know, like each listen is kind of diminishing, you know, and
they're not a bad band. They're just, they feel very by the numbers to me. It's like if you were going to design a ska band, a ska punk band that you wanted to be successful and you designed it by committee, that's what the interrupters sound like. It doesn't have the piss and vinegar that you'd hope, you know. They don't feel like a plucky upstart. They feel like a, like I said, like a focus group created band.
Adam, any closing words to the interrupters?
I've decided it's a band that I shouldn't talk too much about because my criticism of them is the boring one, which is that like I understand that they've been like under Tim's wing, but I just hear too much of Tim in what they're doing, and I feel that
they sound like that Hellcat stuff that you're always talking up, Adam.
I know, but I feel that by even making that criticism, I am in a way like minimizing the band's own agency to make the sound that they want, and I don't want to do that because I remember like who got hit with the same thing. Like the Distillers, immediately upon when they showed up, everyone was just like, "Oh, it's just female Rancid." Blah, blah, blah. But like the Distillers are awesome, right? Like there was like actual.
Real, I don't remember hearing that, but yeah, they were very good.
They got all kinds of like really stupid shit that just kind of boiled down to like dumb internet punk sexism, and I'm worried that like too much interrupters criticism from my end is going to come off like that, and that's not my intent. So I'm just gonna live and let live. They're fine.
In like 2037, like there's a documentary about Interrupters, the greatest band ever, and then it cuts to like an audio clip of Adam White, the Interrupters. I think they're boring, and then it's like the critics had it all wrong, but the people knew, you know. Anyways, you
can we'll go back and record over this part of it, and
Adam. Yeah. We can George Lucas all the old. We should do
we
that.
Can, we can Rolling Stone it. You know, Rolling Stone gave horrible review to like the first Black Sabbath album, and then they have deleted it from history and written some more positive ones.
We could just do what Pitchfork is doing right now, which I don't know if you've noticed.
Oh, this. Are they revising their reviews too?
Pitchfork with Haley.
Pitchfork is in the I don't know. I don't pay attention to like who's writing for Pitchfork. So I'm not, or who's editing there. So I don't really know what the initiative is here, but they have been revisiting all of these, like, I mean, I'll just say all these dumb pop punk records from the early 2000s and the late 90s,
better than me.
Things that when they initially came out, like Pitchfork, this was when Pitchfork was sort of like at their snootiest. Like, I feel like Pitchfork these days is, they're not, as their cultural relevancy kind of declined, they've become a little bit like they express their snootiness now through like championing things that they think you should listen to, as opposed to being just like outwardly pissy about things that they think you shouldn't listen to. But back during that time, they would like anytime any pop punk record came out, like they would slam it or just take it apart. And like things that people loved, like I like no things that you two wouldn't like, but things that like people totally loved, like that, like all those like beloved Jawbreaker records and all that shit, right? Like they would just like shit all over it and give them a 3 or whatever. But now, for some reason in the past year, Pitchfork has been reviewing all this stuff that I wouldn't even necessarily stick up for. They're reviewing old Blink-182 records and giving them 7s and 8s. They're reviewing like My Chemical Romance records from back in the day and giving them 7s and 8s. Like they're going back to the well on all this stuff that like at the time they were too Pitchfork about, and revising it with these like amazing scores and saying these things are like cultural touchstones. And I mean, it's fine to change your opinion on it, but I don't get, it's not like this is like the writer going back and changing their opinion after having been, you know, after having their ears and eyes opened to music. It just to me smacks of this sort of like, it's like they're chasing the, it feels like they're chasing the audience, right? Like this emo revival thing happened, and there's a lot of nostalgia now for this late 90s, early 2000s pop punk and mall emo and stuff like that. And Pitchfork is going to like, they're on board with the revisionist glowing reviews of it. And it's weird. It's weird. I don't get it.
Yeah.
Well, you can always use the podcast at punknews.org. Do you guys want to do record collecting, or do you guys just want to play a song and jump into the news? What do you guys want to do?
I don't care. What's in the news?
Yeah, let's do that. I'm punting on record collecting because I feel like there is a record show that is coming up, so I will actually have bought a record.
Fair enough. All right, well, let's hit some news then. Listen, boys, two Australian bands released a video each this week, and both these bands are buzz bands, and they're kind of separating from each other with regards to their style and how they're positioning themselves in the music scene. Both Amo and the Sniffers and the Chats have released new videos. The Amo and the Sniffers song has been around for a little while, but the video is new. Meanwhile, the Chats song is a new song that's going to be on their upcoming album, which is technically their debut album, but they've already released some other album-ish things in Australia.
Couple EPs.
I don't know. Is eight songs an EP? I guess it is.
I know they call it two EPs.
Depends on the overall length of the release.
Call them EPs, so.
Well, anyways, the Chats have a video for The Clap, which is off their new album called High Risk Behavior. They're also going on tour, and Mean Gene is going with them, and so is a band called The Thick. Meanwhile, Amo and the Sniffers released a new video as well. The video is called Gacked on Anger, which was off their last album. I've got some definite thoughts on both of these, but I'll let you guys – well, you guys want me to fire it up first? You guys want to fire it up?
I definitely have thoughts on both of these, but I feel that I can't separate my thoughts from a video that we are going to talk about later in the show. So you
want to tie that in, the one right after that? Let's tie that in.
Yes, please do.
All right. Also another band that is I would say as hard and as fierce and as wild as the Amo and the Sniffers and as youthful as the Chats, Green Day. They've released a video for a song called Oh Yeah. That's the name of the song. Oh Yeah. And it's out now. It's off their album called Father of All Mother Effers, out on February 7 on Reprise Records, and they're going on the Hella Mega Tour this summer. So let's compare and contrast. We've got two up-and-comers and one legacy act. And not to mention, you know, Green Day's been a band, 30-some years now? If you go see Green Day, sure, there's some older heads there, but a lot of kids are there, too. Like, a lot of kids, like a surprising amount of kids.
My kids, when after, like, the American Idiot era, they love that stuff.
Yeah, man. So anyways, so Adam, your thoughts on Amo, your thoughts on the Chats, your thoughts on Green Day?
So let's set this up right now so that we're not doing a major label band versus independent bands thing, because both.
Ah, but Adam, you're making a mistake already.
No, hold on.
I don't know that any of these other bands are independent, honestly, Adam.
No. That's what I'm saying. Like, so both Amo and the Chats, they've got some industry money backing them. Am I incorrect?
Right.
Right.
Absolutely. You are correct. The Chats are major label, but they're keeping that extremely quietly, and the album is.
Well, they're saying they're putting out the record on their own label, but there was a bidding war, so they basically signed with whoever gave them their own label.
You know what? They're doing what all the bands do these days is that they're going to put it out on some label name that they make up, and there's going to be
major labels distributed by Warner Brothers.
Yeah,
or
right. I mean, everyone's most beloved big bands do that shit these days, and whatever. I can't fight the major label wars anymore because it's not 1997. I mean, like,
you're not Tim Yohannan. You don't care.
I mean, I don't care. It's like I can't fight it anymore, right? I mean, like, everyone's doing it this point, like Pop, right? Everyone was all about like Pop's new album is out on Little Dipper, which is this thing they made up. And it's like, well, like in Canada, Little Dipper is Universal. Like, it's Pop's company, but, like, you know, Universal has the exclusive distribution rights to what Little Dipper is putting out. So for all intents and purposes, it's Universal, right? I think that just the difference these days, I think, is that these bands are at least able to cut savvy deals where they're in kind of control and the major label is there because they see there being money there, as opposed to the major label plucking one of these bands out of nowhere and deciding that, like, with our influence and A&R know-how, we could make this into a band that people care about. So I think maybe that's the difference, but I don't care. Anyways, let's not talk about Pop. So I'm not saying that, like, oh, these cool upstart bands are cool and upstarty, and Green Day is flabby and old. But like, wow, there is such a contrast between these three pieces of music. I mean, like, I'm going to put aside the videos for a minute here, and just talk about them as just songs. Where the Green Day stuff. This new Green Day stuff, I don't I don't understand the intent of the production behind it. Because you could listen to this Oh Yeah song. I mean, and you could envision it played at a 90s Green Day sort of like tempo and recording style. And in that version of the song would be fine. It wouldn't be one of their big singles or anything, but like it would be fine. But this song, you can hear what do they call it? I always get the wrong word for it.
It's a pop song.
I was going to say vocoder, but that's not it. You can hear the fucking Pro Tools. Yeah, you can hear the effect of the computers that are tweaking the voices in it, and they're doing that in that very modern way where they're not trying to hide it. Like when you listen to all those, like say like anything the Offspring recorded, like probably including an After Americana, and any of that stuff, Dexter's voice was gone through, you know, all sorts of like, you know, studio computer tuning to make it hit the highs that it needed to hit. But it never he didn't sound like he was like Cher singing Believe or like the Black Eyed Peas or something, right? Like he still sounded like an adult human and not like a quasi robot thing. But these days, you know, because all the R&B stars basically do it shamelessly, like it's part of their style. Like you listen to a Drake song or whatever, or The Weeknd, and it's all that electronic, you know, but super studio tweaked voices, and they're proud of it. They wear it like a badge. And rock bands have started doing it too, and I can't get over it. I can't get over how the vocals sound in this song. It sounds horrible, and it's different than.
Even if it had a great vocal, it would not save this piece of garbage.
It's not a great song, but you could hear a scrappy young Green Day. It's
pop production. Are they trying to sound like Post Malone or something? It just sucks so bad.
Yeah, like, and now the difference between, I guess, this and the first single from this thing, which was the first single called Father of All Motherfuckers, or
I don't know.
Whatever the first
single I haven't was. Heard anything from this record that I thought was worth wiping your ass with.
The first single is the strangest thing to me, because the first single doesn't sound like Green Day. Like the way that the vocals are recorded in that first single.
Oh no.
If
you didn't know it was Green Day, you would never guess it.
I know it's Green Day. And whenever I hear it on the radio, it takes me like a minute and a half into that song, if I even have it on for that long, to realize.
I was
going to
say, dude,
that,
you're a better man than I.
Like
I'm pushing buttons.
Like it'll be on and I'm like, what is this? And I'm like, oh fuck, this is that Green Day song that doesn't sound like Green Day. And so this one, at least like they kind of sound like Green Day, but they sound like this, like, I don't know what they're doing with the vocals. It is bizarre to me. But so then you listen to the Samuel song, you listen to this Chat song. So, you know, they each also have, you know, they each have the business interests behind them. But at least they sound like fucking rock and roll bands.
So such great riffs, both grinding, driving. Right.
And the vocalists sound like. Like they're people pissed. That are singing in a rock band, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
the one song, the whole point of it is being angry, obviously, but yeah, it's, I love this kid that sings for the Chats. He reminds me of sort of like a Johnny Rotten type, you know?
Yeah. And the, what I don't get is Green Day's whole, like the latest shtick that Green Day and their cohorts are playing into is they're goofing with this whole like big arena rock thing. So they went out and they did that. I don't know if it happened already or not, because I'm not fucking going. But they're doing or did that tour with Weezer, which is called the, I don't know, like,
and Fall Out Boy.
The Hella Mega Tour,
the Big
Hella
Fucking
Mega.
Balls Tour, or whatever they were going to call it, right? Where the whole all of the goofy branding about it was to make it look like it was like the most opulent Van Halen, you know, tour ever.
Yeah,
right?
Like it's Monsters of Rock.
Monsters of Rock, where something. There's, you know, there's jets streaming overhead and explosions and gigantic walls of amps, right? Well, so, okay, so that's what they're joking with. But then the songs they're recording sound like this. Where, like, if you were gonna really lean into being, you know, like a big fucking cocky arena rock band, well, then then why aren't you leaning into music that has a little bit of fire in the belly? I don't get who this is for, and I don't get why. And it is just astonishing to me how much better both Emil and the chat sound in contrast to this. And I'm bewildered, because Green Day could record stuff that sounds as good as those other two songs. They are competent.
No, they can't.
They are competent
and
enough.
They tried when they did the Uno Dos Tres thing, where they kind of tried to return to their punk roots. They just don't have it. They're done. They need to be done.
No. If
they're horrible.
That was just another form. That was just, to me, that was just like another. That was another exercise in excess.
And 21st Century Breakdown. That was the most like attempt they did to do something sort of punky. But they don't have it. They can't write riffs like this. They can't sneer like this anymore. When you become a very, very wealthy person and you've been living in the lap of luxury for 25 years now or 20 years, they can't write with that urgency anymore. I mean, they are what they are. Go see them or don't go see them. I don't care. But they can't make good music anymore.
Now, I have more faith that they never make good music. I'm bewildered that they are choosing actively not to.
Well, you might as well fully embrace the suck.
Why would you want to embrace the suck? What's it gaining them? I don't know
what difference does it make. At this point, you might as well try to go full pop. And that's what they're doing.
I don't know. John, do you like
to... Listen, I'll still listen to Dookie on occasion. And I can even defend Up Through Warning. But because Green Day was a band I always could kind of... You know, they came up the right way. They worked their way through the ranks. They threw their balls off. You know, I never begrudged them their success.
They've
officially become a band that's been bad for longer than they were good. And it's not even close.
It bums me out, because I was the same way. Like, I was never one of these people that like hated on Green Day because they were the big popular band for a few years. And like, I honestly think some of the things that they did were exceptional. Like, Warning, in my mind, is an exceptional record. There is amazing pop songs on that record.
I can't go down that road with you, but I think Dookie is among the best pop punk albums ever made. And Kurt Blanc.
Well, see, and they still have, that material still has a level of goodwill. I got a press release this week from an indie rock band that were... The label was, and this is an indie rock band that is by definition like thoughtful and sleepy in the way that they play. And
like something John I would really be into. Thoughtful and sleepy.
Like super literate, super poetic kind of, right? Now, but this new stuff that they have coming out has like a little bit more fire in the belly than the old stuff. And one of the things that the guy writing the press release or the girl writing the press release put together was they name dropped Kerplunk as one of the things that they were going to make reference to in here. And I'm like, and this is a band that is by every definition, except for the Tom Trauma and John Gentile definition, this is a band that is cool.
The only definitions that really matter,
like,
by the way.
This is a band that is universally cool. Everyone likes this band, right? But
what band is it? Why are you so secretive about it?
Well, because
is it like the Mongoats or somebody? Because
I don't think that they wrote, like, they're not the ones that are writing their own press release. So I'm really talking about the band's publicist more than the band. So I don't really want to put anything on them, right? But the publicist,
Tom, why is Adam being so protective of this band?
I'm talking about
Radiohead.
Oh my god! All right, I'm talking about a band called Nap Eyes. Their fourth record is coming out. They just released a single. The single is called Mark Zuckerberg. I very much like the single. It has a fun.
I saw that on your newsletter.
Video full of ghosts. Anyway, Nap Eyes, like, it's in the name of the band, Nap Eyes. They're a band that is like, they play this kind of
music that makes you want to take a nap.
It's Sleepy Pavement sometimes, right? Like, it's one of those kind of bands, and that's fine.
Pretty sleepy.
And that's fine. If they're one of these bands where like the singer is a legit poet, and like you and people just like pour over their lyrics because it's full of all these like crazy little turns of phrases and stuff like that. But anyways, in the press release for the Nap Eyes single that just came out, they name dropped Kerplunk. Now, if you're a band like this that's on, and they're on Hip Labels, they're on Jaguar and Paradise of Bachelors and all these things, right? So you're a band that is like on the indie rock gravy train, right? Like you're on the coolest labels. Pitchfork loves your stuff. People are devoted to you in crazy ways. You're a band's band. People at other bands like you, one of those kinds of things. You're still gonna name drop Kerplunk in your press release because that is a certain mark of quality for a certain sound, and people can latch onto that. And I'm like, it's amazing to me that something like Kerplunk, this Green Day product, can still have like that level of goodwill that a band like Napeyes, or at least the people trying to sell a band like Napeyes, can go associate themselves with it. And at the same time, Green Day can be like churning out like dumb trash like this. It's like the disconnect between those two things is amazing.
So anyways, oh, I see. You're saying people are saying, oh, the greatness of X, but now X is really, really bad. That is an interesting dynamic.
It would be like, I don't know, like a real estate publication writing about the great deal making of Donald Trump, but completely ignoring the fact that he is the president of the United States and everything that involves. Like it's like just the separation of those two things is crazy to me. Now, but I really made this about Green Day. John, you want to bring us back home here and talk about those this AML thing and this chats video?
I don't know if it's fair to compare these two bands because just because they're both from Australia, but I think it's fair to compare them. They're both from Australia. They're both basically straight up punk, and they both kind of had 80s retro fashion. But I wonder if that's how everyone in Australia looks. And so maybe it's not retro to them. Anyways, the AML track friggin' rips, man. The band had a lot of buzz before their album came out due to their three singles, technically. And the album came out, and the buzz kind of died down. And I think that's because they did kind of the punk thing in that they actually – like a lot of bands, when they go major or you know, whatever, try to break through the mainstream, they either do an indie rock sound instead of a punk sound, or they do the Green Day thing where you slow down and the autotune. Instead, AML, they kind of withdrew from the catchiness and amped up the speed and power. And in fact, when I listened to that at first, the only album, I actually kind of didn't like it for the first two or three times because it wasn't as catchy as the singles. And then it hit, and I'm like, oh my God, this AML record is amazing. I think I put it as number three on my favorite of 2019. It rocks. I think the video is hilarious, and it's somewhat – it's got Amy throwing like some marquee or something into a dumpster, and you can make that imply whatever you kind of want to. I kind of think I know what they're getting at, but I think they're also smartly somewhat ambiguous and not too on the nose. Aristocracy, that's the word I was looking for. Meanwhile, the chats video is hilarious. I mean, all of the chats videos are really funny. The one thing that troubles me about the chats is, and Adam doesn't seem concerned about this, I think Tom isn't either, and maybe they're right to be, I don't know, is that when the chats first came to Philadelphia, they played a tiny, tiny club. Same with Amos, actually. Next time, they played a tiny club, but not as tiny, and there's two shows. Now they're coming to Philadelphia, they're playing the TLA, which is a relatively big venue. And this exact pattern somewhat happened with
Amos. But they're opening. They're not headlining.
No, chats are headlining, Tom. Headlining.
Oh, I thought Mean Jeans was headlining.
No. Mean Jeans is at the bottom.
Below Thick or whatever?
And tellingly, Mean Jeans is below Thick, even though Mean Jeans is way more well known
than Thick.
Right. So, but that's because chats are a major label band. And so
interesting. Yeah. I thought they were in the middle of the bill, huh?
I like the chats. I have the last EP or album, whatever you want to call it. And I will say, and maybe this is just my bias and maybe I'm wrong, but the album isn't quite as exciting as the album with the video, honestly. Like the comedy of the video is a big part of it.
The way they look is definitely something.
Well, the latest ones, the guy's got VD and he's got them like taking care of his VD.
They look like, you know, do you think they're all trying to look like Mel Gibson from The Road Warrior? Is that why they wear their?
Yeah, I think
the greatest Australian movie ever, The Road Warrior.
I think sort of yes, to tell you the truth. I think they're trying to look like Australian dirtbags, but they're not really. I mean, I like them. They seem like nice kids. But what I was saying, the regrets had the exact same trajectory. They came to Philadelphia one year. They played a tiny, tiny, tiny club. 8 months later, they came back. They played a bigger club. A year later, they came back and they played a Live Nation venue. It's the exact same trajectory.
That's what you're supposed to do, though. I mean, that's sort of organic, right?
That might be what, except for that doesn't that happen for Mean Jeans? No. Did that happen for it kind of did happen for the Interrupters, but there might
they
be.
They still had to be able to draw. It doesn't matter how much money you got behind you. You're not going to play for an empty. You're not going to keep moving up venue size if you're not drawing.
True. However, advertisement and hype. That's the thing. Yeah. To me, it feels like an investment.
So are you going to see him at the Live Nation venue?
I was actually going to, but because it was $22. But after fees, it was $40. I'm like,
go to the venue and get the tickets. Go to the box office.
Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. Though on it, it's weird. Sometimes they charge you the fee anyway, and sometimes they don't. You know, the point.
Forget it. I'll tell you later.
Last time I saw the chats, the band were cool. They weren't. Last time I saw Amel and the Sniffers, they were super amazing. Last time I saw the chat. They were cool, not amazing, but man, the audience, and this is not fair to apply to the band because it's not their fault. The audience was the broiest audience I've been to in over a decade. I mean, I was really surprised. It was like ultra bro. It was mega frat boy. Like, it's all frat boys. And I'm like, wow, this is a punk band, but the entire audience is dickbag frat boys. And they were dicks. I mean, they really were dicks.
It's funny.
But let me finish this thought, though.
Yeah,
the point being is I'm somewhat bothered, and honestly, long term, I don't think it's that big of a threat, but I'm somewhat bothered in that the chats seem to be an investment in that whatever forces are with a major label that's behind them, they purposely take out way more advertisers than they need to sell out every club they play, which is what happened. And they're a cool band, and the video was a buzz video. And then they play the bigger club, and that sells out, you know. But there's so much money being poured into them to making them a buzz band or whatever that it actually is paying off, and that's why they're filling out venues. It actually backfired for the Regrets because the Regrets booked all these big venues, and they didn't sell them out. They actually had to cancel a bunch of shows because the investment didn't work. I think with the chats, the investment will work. But what I'm saying is, and not that I really care because the consumers are frat bros. What do I give a shit, you know? But the point being is, it seems like there are, I don't want to say hidden forces, but difficult to trace forces, which are what making these bands bigger and bigger. And so it implies a couple of things. A, you know, if major label bands want to be major label, that's fine. But they're starting to venture into the DIY scene, which they've done since the start. But that's not a great feeling, you know. The second thing is if you can't see why these bands are getting bigger and they just are getting bigger. I mean, even I was checking out the chats, and the reason I was checking them out is because they were a buzz band. Is maybe we're not in control of the media we consume as much as we think we are, and that's the threat suggested by the chats. And I realize I'm getting a little bit heady here, and they're a cool band and they're a fun band, but I am bothered in that they are a major label band, but they seem to follow this trajectory, and the major label aspect is very hidden off in a corner that's difficult to find. Why are you hiding it unless there's a reason you want to hide it? That's the question.
Well, credibility, obviously.
You see, this, I'm so torn on that because I had all that suspicion, you know, 15, 20 years ago about stuff. Like, do you remember the amount of like back talking and backlash that came about with like Be Your Own Pet, where
yes,
where they were this cool, like, you know, charged up punky band that showed up that all of a sudden everyone was talking about, and then it was all of a sudden revealed, I guess, that like, oh well, like the singer's father was a record executive or something, right?
And I think it was the mother, actually,
or something, right? There was something like that, and then it was like, oh, like then that took the wind out of it, right? Where you had that risk, whereas now there's, I mean, I'm gonna circle back to, like, there was a little bit of sexism in that. Because there were other people that had that exact same situation where it didn't seem to matter. Like, in particular, like the dude from the Strokes, like, you know, his what is his name?
Casablancas.
Like were his one or more of his parents not some record bigwig somewhere? But that didn't seem to matter to people as much. But. Like, I remember, like, Be Your Own Pet was one of these bands that, like, it was cool, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, everyone's aware of what's going on, and the wind came out of it, and that could happen to a band. And then like sometimes it didn't. And it's hard to peg what the reason was, but you were always kind of self-conscious that you'd be like really into backing one of these bands that turns out to be like, you know, so someone's marketing play. And that made a lot more sense to me, like back in the days when like culture was a little bit more monolithic, like, you know, you would reasonably expect that, you know, a lot of people in your peer group would be into, say, if they weren't into hip hop, they were into rock and roll. And like, those are the two things that people seem to really focused on. Where at this point, you know, everyone's so fucking fractured and they, you know, they're all over the place and they're listening to watching YouTube stars and playing video games and everything else, where you can't say the culture is a monolith anymore. So like at this point, it's like, do I need to be worried about, you know, some cabal inside Universal trying to press a band? Because even if they were wildly successful, what's it going to get them? Like a few thousand dollars more than the shitty band that didn't have that. Cause I'm not convinced that anyone is paying attention.
I don't know if I can agree with the concept that if the media that you are consuming is controlled secretly for interests that you're not clear of, then it doesn't matter. I don't think I can agree with that, Adam.
It's not that it doesn't matter. It's just that like it feels like those entities have so much less power than they did. And the fact that they don't just makes me care less about their influence. Like I was a lot more scared of Universal when it was this, or actually let's use Warner, right? Like I was way more scared of Warner Brothers when it seemed like such a massive money filled corporation that they could turn around and they could snatch my beloved Rancid, right, out from not only success in the independent world, but success in the independent world that had been going on for a decade to the point where they had their own beloved little label, to snatch Rancid out of those out of the loving bosom of Hellcat and Epitaph, and to go sign them to like the Sire imprint or whatever they brought back, right? That Warner had that power to me was always kind of scary. Like same with like Universal or anything, right? And it really felt like, you know, back when say like Island Records was pumping money into like bands like the Bronx, back when no one heard of them, like to get that band a leg up. Like you'd look at it and go like, man, like there are forces happening here that I'm not aware of, but they control the conversation, and it feels bad that this is like trying to intrude upon my subculture. But at this point, I'm like, you know what? Even if Universal was wildly successful at whatever they're trying to do, Universal is still fucked because they're all fucked. Like none of these.
I don't know if I can agree with that, Adam. I mean, and not to use the Chinese government as the boogeyman, but the Chinese government is not the Chinese government, but the Chinese corporation, which is very tethered by the Chinese government, is now a minority partner in Universal Music Group. That unquestionably means that the material released by Universal Music Group is somewhat honed to the requirements of the Chinese government, as the NBA proved quite explicitly. So therefore, if those major labels are trickling down to the DIY culture, that is somewhat dangerous and scary to me. And also, you know, it shows that the tendency of these kinds of things is here's something big and dumb and fun without any real meaning. And that to agree that blocks out more meaningful discussion and contemplation.
I don't disagree with that point. I'm just saying how it feels. And in a Star Wars context, we're after Return of the Jedi right now. We're like, there's still Empire out there, but they're all like in like factions run by warlords, and it's kind of fucked up.
That, Adam, I'd have to say we're more like, I'm trying to think of a sci-fi equivalent, kind of like Blade Runner or something. No, aliens. We're an aliens where some giant corporation is controlling things from behind the scenes, and you can't even see their machinations. In Star Wars, you know what the Empire's doing. They're blowing up that planet. That's a bad thing. Everybody agrees that's a bad thing. Whereas with the Phelan Watuni company, you know, are they doing, is it, are what they doing, is that bad? You know, why is it so secretive? Anyways, the point being is,
the point being is, it's Weyland Yutani, and your mangling, your mangling of that, John, has wounded me.
Well, aliens does rule. Anyways, the real question is, why are major labels investing in rock bands of all things?
That is the real question. We need to sum
this up really quick. Let me sum up what's going on here with these three videos, since we've walked away from it, and I really didn't get to say a whole lot about it other than interjecting a little bit. The Green Day is horrible. Nobody should be listening to them. Just, they have enough money. We don't need to listen to Green Day anymore. Amel and the Sniffers are a good band, and I've come around on them. I was hesitant to embrace them.
They are an amazing band.
But they very much embrace the millennial attitude of, we've been screwed. Our generation has been screwed by those who came before.
Have you listened to the album? I don't get that message at all.
The new song, that's what it's all about, isn't it?
No, Gack Don't Anger is literally just about her being like addicted to anger.
Well, what I got the impression that it was sort of one of those "woe is us" millennial songs. Okay, so maybe I'm wrong. I got to listen to it more. But I like the album. I like the band. But B, being already, I've already been described earlier tonight as being a non woke punk, and I think that's why I like Chat so much. It's so funny. It's so non politically correct, you know. It makes me kind of sad that also like attracts that frat boy element. Maybe I can't get behind him as much as I thought, but I appreciate that.
Playing the band for that, you know.
Well, at some point you have to equate the two, though. You know, I mean, is it Dropkick Murphy's fault that they have an audience full of bros?
Yes.
All right, fair enough. All right, anyway, Chat's good, Amel good, Green Day bad. That was it. That's all I wanted to say. I just wanted to sum that up, make it a really easy bullet points.
But I do want to investigate the question is, why are major labels investing in rock band? I mean, I think maybe
rock's poised for a comeback, dude.
Well, Greta
Van Fleet tearing up the charts.
You know, like McDonald's in like Indiana, they'll do like, come get the McDonald's seafood burger, you know, and they'll see if it does well. And if it does well, then they do it in other markets. I suspect that's what this is.
Seafood burger.
Well, anyway, let's play a song. Adam or Tom, do you guys have specific songs for this? Not, I actually have some Philly songs to play.
I mean, if you're eager to go, I can throw one in later.
Let's play some Amel, and then let's play some Chats. How about that?
Why don't we play the new Chats?
Let's play the bands backed by major labels that are going to sue us. Do it.
I drank for the right glass. I'm taking the right path. Yeah.
That was a screaming.
That was quite the brawl.
It was a screaming lawsuit waiting to happen. All right, so some other stuff happened this week. Let's talk about. Look at this. We're almost an hour in. Let's talk about some of these stories quick because you probably care about them, but they're maybe not. They're not debate stories per se. So the first one that you probably want to know about is that Laura Jane Grace is recording. She's recording demos at a rapid pace. Back on the last week, she tweeted out that she had recorded 17 demos in 5 days. So that's quite.
But we have no idea what project for, right? There was no indication.
No, right. And I mean that's the curious thing now is because what's the non against me band?
Devouring Mothers, Laura Jane Grace and the Devouring Mothers.
Right, and was there another?
Yeah, I think it was like the Black Crows, but it wasn't the Black Crows or something.
Well, like I said, though this Devouring Mother, but that was more like acoustic bass, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I feel like
the funny thing was until Transgender Dysphoria Blues, Against Me was a very prolific band, and they slowed way down to make that record, and the follow up wasn't too slow, but they always were a band that could crank out a record every 2 years, which is kind of a rare feat anymore. But maybe they'll get back to that.
Yeah. So,
or maybe this would be something totally different. Who knows?
So this would be what would this be? The fall. Assuming that this is that some of the stuff ends up on Against Me stuff. This would be the follow up to what Shapeshift with Me,
right?
I was going to say, I couldn't even think of it.
Which is 2016, which is forever ago.
Yeah.
So, that's actually kind of like a shockingly long time ago. So anyways,
didn't it take like 4 years to make Transgender Dysphoria Blues? It was a long time compared to the previous albums.
There was, but like given like the amount of life changes that she was going through at that point.
That was a heavy, heavy album. And the follow-up definitely felt lightweight in comparison, unfortunately.
Yeah, so anyways, there is potentially new Against Me stuff that is on the way that people are always always excited about. We've been talking about like things that happen on Twitter for some reason a lot this episode, and it's not all just Tom getting shit for being an asshole.
I'm not even on Twitter, so
someone from the Toronto music world, they went out and I gotta find this thing that they posted. Let's see here. I gotta pull this up because Laura Jane chimed in on it. They went and they basically asked the universe to answer for folk punk and who is responsible. And someone looped in Laura and they're like she's responsible. And oh, here it is. I found it. So this is a band from Toronto that's actually a pretty fun power pop band called Pretty Maddie. But they went and they posted something where they said, "Who will be held accountable for the rise of folk punk in the 2010s? They have to pay." And then someone responds and like loops in Laura Jane Grace. And Laura's answer was, "I back late 70s, 80s, and 90s folk punk, and maybe some 2000 to 2002 folk punk, but anything outside of that is questionable at best." And I was like, "Oh, I don't disagree." So that's nice. Do you remember there was this like proliferation? I can't even mention the bands because I feel like they've all yelled at me on the internet at some point. But they were everywhere. It was just like,
oh, folk punk bands. Oh my god!
I mentioned them not, but there was this Post Against Me group of bands that were at one point very angry at punk news for all sorts of reasons that were, not entirely accurate. So, anyways, Laura Jane's recording. That's kind of cool.
After the episode, we should talk. I'm not sure I know who that is.
You know who that
is. Was that the first big scuffle?
I don't know.
We'll talk about it after
the episode. There's so many fucking scuffles. There's so many fucking scuffles in those bands. Anyways, what else? What else? What else? Sheermag, Young Gov. John, you do this one.
Yeah, okay. Sheermag and Young Gov are going on a tour. It'll probably be pretty cool. I don't necessarily remember why I put this in here. So the question is, actually, I'll tell you why. I know why I put this in. The rumor is that Sheermag is breaking up at the end of the tour. And the question is, why is she and Mac breaking up at the end of the tour? And I'll just be frank. When the first three Sheer Mag singles came out in Philadelphia, people were like, oh my God, Sheer Mag's the greatest thing ever. And I was like, yeah, Sheer Mag's cool. I dig him. I don't love him. And people were genuinely mad at me because I liked Sheer Mag. I didn't love Sheer Mag. And I do like Sheer Mag. But then the album came out and the buzz died down. And they put out the second album. Buzz got even lower. They put out the third album, which I think was supposed to be like the big strike back. And no one really cared. Well, not that no one cared, but it didn't have the heat of this, especially the second single with the one song. I can't remember the name of it. It's about economic equality, the single. Anyways, so the point being is the rumor, and this is unconfirmed, is that they're going to break up at the end of the tour or at least go on hiatus, and that's why they're playing two Philadelphia shows. So I don't know if you guys have any perspective on Sheer Mag. Some people, well, actually a lot of people love them so much that they started getting haters just because they had some people that love them so much. But I'm excited to see Sheer Mag, Young Gov, and Zorn at what might be the final Sheer Mag show ever, maybe.
I don't know too much about that, but you should go see Young Gov.
I private messaged John, and actually John and I had a conversation about it. I said, what is the deal with Sheer Mag? What's so good about this band? And he sort of convinced me they were good. They're kind of cool, kind of a mellow Thin Lizzy kind of sound.
My question
about them is actually why they're being embraced by the punk community. Explained it to me.
Well, that's an excellent question, Tom. The misstatement is that, they sound like Thin Lizzy, and everyone loves Thin Lizzy, which is annoying to me because I've always loved Thin Lizzy, and Thin Lizzy was not cool for the longest time. And then some cool person, I don't know who it was, said, Thin Lizzy is cool, and so Sheer Mag is cool too. And then all the people that follow the leader, they're like, yeah, we love Thin Lizzy. And all of a sudden I see all these Thin Lizzy t-shirts all over, all these AC/DC shirts. And I'm like, I loved AC/DC and Thin Lizzy in the 90s, and all I got was shit because of it, and now it's cool. Wow. And that's very annoying. Anyways, the reason that Sheer Mag is an important and interesting band and is because the lead singer, the band plays, 70s power rock, right? But what's interesting about that is the lead singer does not fit the stereotypical, I'm wanting the word cock rock, but the 70s rock is not cock rock. The 70s rock guy, the David Lee Roth, the Robert Plant, the Phil Lynott, the big cool guy that, has sex with all the chicks, drinks all the time, and plays awesome guitar. The lead singer is not that at all. It's a young lady named Tina. And so she purposefully, I guess you could say, subverts that expectation. The second thing is, while a lot of those kinds of bands, especially like right now, there's a lot of bands that are retro 70s cock rock, kind of like, Gygax or even the Whips, like, they're purposely vapid in that their songs aren't really about anything. They're about partying and having fun, blah, 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 which can be fun. What's interesting about Sheer Mag is they take that structure and they put very crass style lyrics in there. The big single, which I can't remember the name of, it's about economic equality and burning down rich people's houses. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing to do or the right thing to do, but it's interesting that they're taking basically crass politics and putting it to a Thin Lizzy beat. And the lead singer is someone that is the complete opposite of your standard 70s cool male rock star, which is interesting. I just wish that the albums were had a little bit more variety, to tell you the truth.
There you go. Both halves of our listenership should totally go get into those two Young Gov records that came out, though, because they're delightful.
Are they great? I check them out a little bit, but honestly, I wanted to buy them. I saw him open for Vivian Girls, and he was awesome. Vivian Girls were amazing, but the records are $20 each. I'm like, I don't want to drop $40 on.
Selling them now as a what is it? Run for Cover is the label. Selling them as a double LP now, so you don't have to buy them separately. I don't know if that saves you any money in particular. I haven't got a physical copy of it myself, so I'm not really sure. But that guy is such an incredible pop songwriter.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You might have just been about to ask me what I was going to say. Like, you totally get his secret side career, his not so secret side career. So this Young Gov is Ben Cook, who's the singer for a hardcore band called No Warning, and he also plays one of the guitars in Fucked Up. And like, unlike all of that loud ass shit that he does as being part of those two bands, and No Warning is like a New York hardcore style hardcore band at time that is like a little bit metal, even like it's loud, tough, like over the top tough stuff. And but he is also I want to say Moonlights, but that makes it sound like it's a side job, and I don't really know to what degree this is his job. But he writes songs for pop stars. He shadow writes or ghost writes or whatever you want to call it for
Katy Perry.
It was a Katy Perry,
Taylor Swift. They got a song through to her, but I think she didn't actually record it.
Yeah, so there's a fair amount of apparently like songwriting he's done for huge pop stars, because like he has those chops to be able to do that. So that's kind of why I love his like Young Gov, like it allows him to flex that muscle in a way where he's writing like very like Britpoppy power pop kind of stuff with it, but it allows him to be that pop guy in a way that I think is quite cool. But then even more so than that, like if you go back to like some of his like earlier punk side projects, they fucking kill. Like I don't know, like we ever into the Marvelous Darlings.
Yeah, I've got one of their 7-inches. I really like his band with Damien Abraham. Is it Pink? Pink Eye? Pink Eye's the band.
Yeah, there's that guy is just like he has an incredible amount of stuff that's out there that he's recorded that's all kind of good. So go check out Young Gov. And is
Young Gov getting what he deserves and wants with his solo career?
I don't know what he wants. I mean, he has that like purposefully difficult, like him and Mike Halchuk to me are like two peas in a pod as far as like the way that they interact with the outside world. So like, I'm never quite sure if he wants to talk to anyone, if he wants the attention, if he's like somehow contemptuous of the universe that's writing about his music, or if he's genuinely just like genuinely into it. Just like he has that like whiff of mystery that like say like Damien certainly does not, because Damien is just like a big huggable, you know, Damien kind of like lays it all out there. All of his insecurities and like loves and enthusiasms and things he's fighting about. Like, but some of the other fucked up guys are just, you know, I'm never sure what to read out of them. And Cook's definitely on that end of it for me.
Fair enough.
The Beasties, they have a film that is going to come out. So there's gonna be a Beastie Boys film. It is going to be of a stage show that they performed in New York and Philadelphia last year. It is directed by Spike Jonze. It is called The Beastie Boys Story. It centers on Mike D and Ad Rock telling the history of the group. It's going to screen to select IMAX screens on April 3rd. And then it's going to be released on the Apple TV, assuming on that Apple TV Plus digital thing that they have, on April 24th. John wrote IMAX as if it was iPod, where he lowercased the I, and it is really, really throwing me.
Brainwashed by the Chinese.
It's throwing me, man. I'm trying to read this, and I can't get through the sentence because I'm like, IMAX? Jesus, fuck. So the group stated, this is a quote from them, they said, "Wait, what? I just heard that Mike Diamond and Adam Horowitz have made a movie about Beastie Boys and their lives growing up around lots of crazy ass shit in NYC with Spike Jonze. Is that for real?" So there you go. It's coming out. I'm excited to see it. I got nothing else. John, what do you got?
I saw it last year.
The live thing or the film?
The live thing.
And?
I think we're going to – it was a little loose. I saw the first show, which I think was the practice show in Philadelphia. It was a little loose. It's the history of the band. It is quite moving at parts. And I'm just glad that the Beastie – I mean, well, I don't know if I wish the Beastie Boys – well, the two surviving Beastie Boys would do something together. Maybe not as the Beastie Boys, but as something else. But, I mean, I am glad that they are properly archiving the band and telling the story of the band – in their words and from their vision, unlike, say, I don't know, the Sex Pistols, which was told by everybody else before the Sex Pistols actually told it, or the Ramones, which was told by everybody else before they could actually tell. And even the Ramones are not trustworthy sources. Whereas I get the impression the Beastie Boys are basically trustworthy. They are reliable narrators. So I'm glad we're getting the story of the bands in multiple formats, book, movie, audiobook, from the people that were there to begin with. And it's well done. What I saw had what didn't flow totally smoothly, but I saw the practice show, and I'm sure they're going to edit it to make it tighter. So it'll be cool, man. Beastie Boys rule. I literally just bought a Beastie Boys 7-inch yesterday. I bought Intergalactic, a jukebox single backed by Peanut Butter Jelly Time.
Oh, cool. How you doing, Tom?
Oh, you know, drifting off. I'm drifting off. But no, I would definitely watch this movie. I'm cool with the Beasties.
Saw them
when they were all three alive. Did you ever get to see them, John, or no?
I saw them twice, Thomas. I saw them on the Hello Nasty tour, and I saw them on the To the Five Boroughs tour.
I hate you both.
I saw them with Rollins Band opening.
Oh, that's like 92?
I think 92, yeah, 92, 93.
Did you know that there is a CD EP of the Rollins Band where they do, honestly, kind of an insufferable 30-minute jam, but halfway through it, they do the Rollins Band covers Beastie Boys' Gratitude, which is kind of cool.
Oh, I don't know that. I didn't know that.
You know, I had tickets to the Rhyme and Reason tour, and then fucking Mike D fell off his bike, and it never happened. Now here I am. Here I am. You remember that? He fell off his bike. You see, I do, because it was like a tragic occurrence for me. So there was a tour in 2000 where it was supposed to be Rage Against the Machine and the Beastie Boys, and then like a bunch of other bands they were going to curate as like a little festival around that called Rhyme and Reason. It was going to tour all over the place. I totally had tickets, and then Mike D hit a pothole, fell off his bike, broke his arm or something like that. They had to cancel the tour because he was unable to get out there. And then everything that happened to Rage and the Beasties after that happened. And that tour did not. And here I am.
That's wrong. It was cool. It was real cool.
Not unfortunate, because it was cool, but I saw them when they were doing the thing where they were really trying to play their instruments and stuff again and really kind of turning back on their first couple albums.
Oh, see, that'd be neat.
But it was good. It was cool. Was in a hockey rink.
I did get to see like that era Rage in a hockey arena, which was kind of fun, but that's not the Beasties.
I saw Rage play at a small club. And then I saw him at Lollapalooza 93. But I'm old.
So I'm a geezer. So what are we doing? Is anyone else playing a song? Or are we talking about the garden? John, you want to talk about the garden? I'm going to say we're not going to talk about the garden because John keeps cutting out and I can't hear him. So he's not going to be on this recording from this point forward.
I fell asleep. John's not on the recording. It's going to be a long day.
Yeah, I haven't heard John since I started talking about Rhyme and Reason, to tell you the truth. Every once in a while I hear a bleep or a bloop and... I don't know what that is. I'm going to blame the tubes. All right, here's what we're going to do. I'll play a song, and then we will come back in a sec to wrap it up, and maybe John will have returned to us from whence he went. So this is a band from London, Ontario, called Red Arms. They had a record that came out in late 2019 called Critical State. I premiered this song, or a video for this song, on Punk News the other day, and it in an incredible rare occurrence, had a bunch of positive comments. Like, didn't have the complete indifference, didn't have the negative.
Or the, like, first comment where somebody says, this is horrible.
No, there were, like, five people that were like, I enjoy this. Which was...
Must be moles.
Which was very, very, very confusing to me. So the song I'm going to play is that song. It's called All That Noise. The band on record is a little bit more charged up and punky than this song in particular. This one has some kind of like 90s college rock stuff going on in it. There's a little bit of Dinosaur Jr., a little bit of Husker Du, but it's super satisfying. So there you go. So this came out on vinyl on Yeah Right Records and on cassette on Reel to Reel. So the song is called All That Noise by Red Arms out of London, Ontario. Here you go. Okay, we're back, I guess. Podcast at punknews.org is how you email us. Is John Gentile with us?
I'm here, sort of.
Oh, there he is.
I mean,
overmodulated.
He sounds like Max Headroom, but I don't know. John, do you want to
see you next week?
Bye. Bzz,
bop, beep, smell you later.